From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
It begins with a very wealthy woman going to a luxury hotel for an afternoon with a man who is not her husband. And an hour later, she is dead.
I can go to the Dáil in the morning quicker than I can go into the council buildings in Galway. That is the congestion that's in Galway at the moment. Mm-hmm.
One, for example, is our suffering is believing there's a way out. You see, it all sounds quite dark, doesn't it?
It's the darkness before the light. Is it?
Coming up on this, have we peaked too soon on the Sunshine Front edition of Playback Daily? An impossible murder, Jane Casey on her new crime thriller, bypass or light rail system, Galway's gridlock dilemma, and Get Real, Oliver Berkman on embracing our limitations. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that doesn't know what the word limitation means. Oliver Callan was back this morning, and he started off his monologue, terms and conditions apply, with the blackouts in Spain and Portugal.
Spain and Portugal all over the news all across the world because of the power outage. What caused it? Was there a cyber attack? They basically do not know. Spain, Portugal, some of southwest France as well, of course, all caught up in this huge power cut, which went across the... has frightened people because of the potential of living in the Middle Ages for just a few hours. Oh, there were people in the west of Ireland and the Midlands across the northeast going, "We were there! We were there! How long did theirs last?" Ours was 3 weeks and sometimes even beyond. And no, it went for many hours yesterday. Houses, offices, trains, traffic lights. The Madrid Open tennis tournament were all struck. Chaos for millions and a scramble by all the various government officials and network operators to find out what the hell happened. The official explanation is extreme temperature variations in the interior of Spain. They always use very haughty language at times like these. Anomalous oscillations in the very high voltage lines. Well, you'd expect it to be high voltage, that's why the lights stay on. And the phenomenon is known as induced atmospheric vibration, which is definitely not something they just made up yesterday afternoon. But it is Spain, so they couldn't help themselves by giving the whole thing a sexy moniker. I mean, we just went with Storm Eowyn. Blackouts, misery, called what we did. They said no, they were hit by El Cero, which is basically the zero. So it is El Cero, started at 11:33 in their summertime over there and went on to mid-afternoon in some parts. It went up to the middle of the overnight, in fact, to a lot of Spain. And El Cero has caused a lot of troubles and they don't know what's happened. Spain's National Security Council has been convened to assess the outage. Portugal's Prime Minister said too early to say what caused the blackout. And people are, some of the right-wing Tory press in Britain are saying, oh, this is net zero, which is their drive towards zero emissions and energy. That's what, we don't know what caused it, but probably net zero, probably the thing we don't like. And we confirm our bias, that's the one. Spain, it might surprise you, is a green energy leader in Ireland due to the lots of sun they have and the wind. And there was a record period. 56% of all the electricity they used last year was renewable. By 2030, 5 years' time, they will have 81% renewable energy. And we're going, oh, by 2030, we hope to have like one extra windmill in this country because of the court system and judicial reviews. They don't have that beyond in Spain. It's civil law, not common law. And they make thousands of court decisions every year, whereas we're in the mere hundreds and so on.
For the Irish angle on El Zero, and, you know, just to sabotage the whole notion of a monologue, Oliver got talking to Dublin woman Maria O'Reilly, who's in Spain with her mother.
When did you know something had gone terribly wrong?
When I went across, I'd had a cup of coffee. I'd say we had the last cup of coffee in Calpe because we were in a cafe sitting outside and I paid cash. The lad was talking about, you know, cash, and he was speaking in Spanish to somebody, but I had cash in my purse, paid for that, and I left Mam. She went back to the apartment. I was going over to the supermarket to pick up a few bits, and the supermarket had a band across, all in darkness, and the man said, no, it's closed.
Right.
So I went around to another one, thinking that was just a one-off, maybe that supermarket.
Yeah.
And the next one, they were saying the same. It was on, and you could see as you were going along, all the shops had no lights on. Doors were still open, but the lights were off. So I found Mam just as she was walking in to the door. We're up on the fifth floor, so the lifts were out.
Oh, my God. And she had an injury recently, didn't she?
She did. She had a fall in November, but she's doing wonderful. She broke her pelvic bone or one of those bones.
Oh,
but she's doing absolutely wonderful. with one stick. So we took it very slowly up the stairs. And, yeah, we were watching from our balcony. And you could see people were not really concerned at that stage. Towards the evening, you could see people getting more concerned.
Right.
But, you know, they were all out on the beach. It was a beautiful day yesterday. Beautiful day here today, too.
Yeah, you're in the holiday region, so I presume people were just outside enjoying themselves.
We were on the beach. Yeah, they were swimming. People, you know, all along the beach. And we did notice when we went down, Mammy went down first, just to have a little recce around. Mm-hmm. And she said there were still some people out and they were sitting outside. And but when we went back down to see if we could get something to eat, because we're all electric, we couldn't cook here, nor did we have anything to cook with. We only had enough for a sandwich for lunch. Yeah, we noticed there was people sitting outside, but they were having beer or drinks or ice cream rather than cooked meals.
Yeah, there was no cooking.
We managed to find one.
Across the whole of Spain, you can imagine the panic in Spain.
Yeah. Now, there was one restaurant we found, and they either cooked by gas or they had a generator, but they provided us with a lovely meal last night.
We were very lucky.
Yeah.
So you didn't really sense any of the chaos. Obviously, lots of news reports as though it was an Armageddon film, a really bad one where people are running around.
Yeah, we couldn't get any news. There was no news. We'd no radio, we'd no TV, we had no internet. I couldn't make a phone call home. The only reason why I knew it wasn't just this town was my son managed to get a text to me to tell me.
Aha, and the phones came back on because the mobile phones were down for a couple of hours as well.
Oh, they were down. Well, they were down till we went to bed. They were down till we woke up this morning here.
Right.
We couldn't make a phone call out at all.
So you'd no idea this had happened right across the whole country.
No, my brother did manage up very early to get a phone call through to us, and then everything went completely. We couldn't make any calls to or from. You know, we couldn't take a call. Yeah.
It's handy having a bit of. It's handy having cash, isn't it?
It was. I had a few bob in my purse and very, very handy because, again, you could see people going to ATMs, but they had no way of getting cash.
They were blank.
Everything had closed down. Yeah.
People think ATMs work manually, that there's someone twisting a kind of a crank at the other end.
you could see them, though, getting more panicky as, you know, we were out and we came back just before it got dark because I knew the stairwell would get really dark. But you could see people starting to go, oh, what if this is going to be more than one day? And in the restaurant, we heard that Spain, Portugal, France and Italy, the Chinese whispers were starting at that stage.
People were claiming Italy had gone into
Italy,
the darkness.
Oh, yeah, we heard Italy had gone. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Did anyone get stuck in the lift? Someone's asking here on the text in the hotel.
Not that we know about. Again, we're on our own here. We only got to speak to a couple of people yesterday, but we were very lucky. Mom was going to go up to her friend who lives on the 9th floor.
Right.
And her friend has lived here for like the last 40 years. Rita from Banagher. Two Ritas in Calpe. Another Rita. And we couldn't... Thanks be to God, Mom didn't go and get stuck in that lift because we would have had no way of getting to her, or, you know.
Because what time did the power actually come back to you?
I noticed about 1:30 this morning because I'd left the bathroom light on, even though it wasn't on. The extractor fan woke me up. So I woke up about 1:30 this morning. Yeah.
That was a long time, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was funny because we were saying, you know, it's like years ago, you'd go to bed when it's dark. Because you can't do anything else. We were very lucky. There's two candles left by previous people in this rented apartment. And we had just bought one of those lighters. We don't smoke. We didn't have a gas hob, so we'd no way of lighting the candles. And we had just bought a lighter.
One of those lighters,
one of those tourist lighters.
Yeah.
So we could light two candles when we came back
because
up.
Because you had candles. Oh, very good. It was great.
Yeah.
Idea.
Spain by candlelight for Dubliner Maria O'Reilly, caught up in the massive power outages in the Iberian Peninsula. Maria was talking to Oliver Callan this morning as part of what became his dialogue, I guess. Galway is, Clare Byrne tells us, one of Europe's most gridlocked cities. A ring road has been in the planning stages for over 20 years, but has yet to materialise. Now, people are calling on the authorities to build a light rail system for the city instead. Clare spoke to Michael Fitzmaurice, independent TD for Roscommon and Galway, and Eamon Ryan, former Green Party leader, about this, and she first asked Michael Fitzmaurice why he favoured the ring road.
First of all, I think we need both. We need a light rail, and the Northern Cork needs it. But let's deal with the facts. In Galway, I think something like 36,000-38,000 cars go into the city from three sides, say the Connemara side, East Galway side, and the Oranmore side, into the city every day. This is the stats and this is the facts. I can go to the Dáil in the morning quicker than I can go into the council buildings in Galway. That is the congestion that's in Galway at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But I suppose if you had the light railway system, you wouldn't have all of those cars going into the city.
Look at it. A lot of things look very simple solutions. Have a look at Dublin, for example. You have Bus, you have Lewis, you have Dart, and you still have a large amount of cars going in. So there's no one-size-fits-all that solves everything. Galway is crying out. And you listen to... say IBEC, we meet them every year. You listen to them once a year when we meet them, and they'll explain to you the necessity for business in Galway to have this outer ring road. Also, if you look at what's lost, if you were to add it up in car time, people sitting in cars, it would be probably up to 400 million a year that people would be losing if either in family time or if they were paid at work for the length of time they're left in their care.
Okay, well, listen.
Galway, and the other thing is clear, that you're not going to have a light rail or Lewis up all sides of Galway because it's not in Dublin in all sides. Have a look at the light rail. It goes to certain areas. That's it. You still will need cars to go from A to B.
Okay,
and if the ring road was put in, it would give people going to A, B, C or D the opportunity to get there faster, but also there wouldn't be congestion in another area that other people would be.
Well, let's hear what Eamon Ryan thinks about that. So just do both, Eamon. What do you say?
I can firstly fully understand the frustration people in Galway have, and this is an issue for the people of Galway City and County, because it is one of the worst, not just in Europe, but probably in the world in terms of traffic. And I would argue the reason for that is for 30, 40, 50 years, we have designed it as around the car, and it will not work. It is not working. And if we keep trying to solve that problem by building more roads to get more cars, it's going to get worse. And the alternative is what Galway hasn't done, and is to build the public transport. And that actually will transform Galway for the better. I remember someone saying once, it was a conference in NUG and this, someone said, God, I wish only we'd built out more Galway when we were building out Galway. Instead, we built the ring road with all the roundabouts on it and developed an out-of-town, sprawled retail parks model that actually takes from the real character of Galway, the sense of community. If we build the public transport, that's what we will get, a city that works.
Just the public transport, not the road.
We need to invest in all sorts of roads right around the country, loads of bypasses and so on. But this is a road which doesn't address the problem. In fact, in my mind, it makes it worse. This is not the investment we should be making. The light rail, as is now, in October last year, we commissioned a major study in government. And it shows it's actually feasible. Because up to that, all the engineers, all the officials, all the county managers in Galway said, oh no, Galway's not big enough to have proper public transport like that. That's not true. It is deliverable. It will work. We could already, we've agreed to the city centre part of the bus connects in Galway. It's the central spine of the main public transport route. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be built in the next year or two. But that's the core difficult part. You can then build that west out towards Knocknacara, people will know Galway, and you can build it east towards GMIT and up towards Parkmore to the big industrial estates. The real problem we have in Galway, one of the biggest problems, is everyone moving from the west side of the city to work on the east side of the city. When you build that light rail system, the distances are relatively short, it's 15 kilometres long, you actually start to solve the problem. And that can be delivered first and foremost by a bus corridor, which is upgraded to light rail, running every 5 minutes. The analysis that we did shows, if you took climate seriously and if you really backed up that plan by designing it around lowering emissions and improving traffic, we would go from a city where public transport at the moment is only about 6-7%, up to 20%. You'd get car numbers down from 60% down to under 40%. And then the problem starts to be solved. You get rid of the gridlock, which is good for those who do have to drive. And that's the choice facing Galway now. Does it go down and on? As my
because if you, colleague, if you are you saying then that if you build the bypass, that you then have, you're just encouraging more cars onto the road. So you could do the public transport in tandem, but actually people would take the easier option.
You're designing Galway as a motorway city. Your design is, Kieran Cannon, the former Fine Gael minister, said it's a 20th century solution that they're trying to put into the 21st century, and we have the alternative.
So does the M50 not work?
No, it doesn't work. It's a perfect example, actually, similar ring road around Dublin. I remember at the time arguing we should build the metro first, and the M50 is now clogged. Everyone in Dublin knows that the biggest problem in Dublin is you don't know how long it's going to take you on the M50. You can get caught there, stuck for hours. And that's what they're planning to do in Galway. And it's not just that you're the road itself, it's that all the planning around it, all the housing, all the retail, all the businesses, you turn Galway into a motorway city. Mm-hmm. And that's not what the smart cities are going now. That's not the future. That's not where you've really good local environment, where you've really good housing. If we build a light rail route, that goes through Ardon, where you could put 20,000 new houses in, really high quality, really good quality public transport system. That's what people want. It's sustainable solutions that give you better housing, better local environment, better sense of community. Or else, you build Galway as a motorway city.
Right. Well, Michael, are you convinced?
Which will never work.
Are you convinced by any of that?
Absolutely not. Look at, I think it's very hypocritical, Eamon, saying what he's saying when he was Minister for Transport. Why so, if he didn't believe, if he believed so little in a motorway that over the last number of years he put 11 million into the basically the funding of different things in relation to the outer bypass? That's the first thing. Second thing is, light rail. Eamon talks about 20,000 houses. And yeah, if you had a light rail going through where there's 20,000 houses, happy days. But the facts are, and for anyone that knows Galway, and Jesus, I know Galway fairly well, that on the west side, you have the west Galway, we'll say Connemara side. You have the east Galway, and you have south Galway. And if you look at the numbers of people, Galway is a very moving city where a lot of people live out the country. Because if on a quiet day, I'll give you a clear, I live near Glenamedy, and on a quiet day, if you went up late at night, you'll do Galway in 35 to 40 minutes. But it's the traffic that's causing basically the problem. And if Eamon is talking about climate, let's deal with Dublin first. Dublin, when the M50, and I remember the M50 when it came, it was the greatest gift that ever came because it alleviated an awful lot of problems. What happened since is that Dublin has grown. The number of people working in Dublin when the M50 came and the number of people. Now, what Dublin actually needs is another ring road outside that, you know, and the people will tell you that.
When the ring road gets congested, build a ring road around the ring road. That's Michael Fitzmaurice, independent TD for Roscommon Galway, and Eamon Ryan, former Green Party leader, talking about the proposed Galway ring road on Today with Clare Byrne this morning. Oliver Berkman is the best-selling author of 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. His latest sort of self-help book, he describes himself as a self-help skeptic, is called Meditations for Mortals, 4 Weeks to Embrace Your Limitations and Make Time for What Counts. And Oliver had a long chat this afternoon with Ray Darcy.
It's sort of an antidote to self-help books, Oliver, is it?
I love hearing it described that way. Yeah, I mean, what I really wanted to do was see if I could write something that would actually help people, as these ideas have helped me, go from kind of knowing what it is you want to do with your life or how you want to work or all the rest of it to actually doing it. Because I found again and again with a certain kind of conventional self-help, it has the opposite effect. You know, you read something, and even if you like it, you think like, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to put that into practice perfectly, but I better wait a few months till I get a free week to really focus on it. And I've got to get all these other things out of the way first. And, you know, before you know it, there are no free weeks. That doesn't happen.
It was quite a selfish exercise for you because you mainly wrote the book for yourself.
I mean, I've always done that on some level. I try to make it engaging and readable to other people, but I am sort of doing therapy in public with these books. And in this case, it was really that feeling that I think I've since discovered, you know, lots and lots of other people have, of kind of being on the back foot, right? So it's always like you're not quite sorted out right now. You're trying to sort your life out. You're trying to get on top of everything. You're trying to get your fitness in gear or sort out some issues in your relationships. But it's always this feeling of like, life is going to begin in the future when I finally get on top of it all. And that's kind of the idea I want to challenge in this.
And you were a self-confessed self-help obsessive at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was writing...
You say that in the opening chapter, you know, that you are...
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, when I was... I wrote this column for The Guardian where you sort of... One of the things I got to do was try out a lot of these approaches. Right. And it's great having the excuse of doing it for work, because all sorts of things that you might be a little bit embarrassed to explore, or books you might not want to be seen reading or something, you just be like, oh, it's for work. Yes. I'm writing this column.
Well, so that's important.
Maybe you know what I'm talking about.
I do. Yeah, I do. But that's important for our listeners to know, because it's not that you've sort of rubbish stuff that you don't know about. You've actually been there. You've done it all. And it is because this is sort of, an ode to imperfectionism as well.
That's the word that I use as a sort of umbrella term for this philosophy that I'm trying to like lead people into. Because I think you can spend your whole life waiting till you are so efficient that you can handle everything, or waiting until you feel ready to make the plunge with some new chapter of your life or a new job or relationship or something. Or you can do this thing that I call imperfectionism, which is to say, like, as humans, we're never going to feel completely ready. We're going to die with a very long to-do list of things that we never got around to doing. Like, this is all just the background state of being a finite human. So you might as well plunge in to doing some of the important, meaningful, exciting things.
So, imperfectionism and the fact that we're finite is a recurring theme. There are recurring themes, but you suggest that it could be done over 28 days. So there's 28 short little chapters with ideas on how to change your perspective on life. And some of them will work for some people, others won't. And you say a lovely thing. And again, it's not the self-help way of doing it. You say that, you know, you don't want people to live this religiously, that some things might stick, they might resonate with you. If they do, great.
Yeah, I think it's so unhelpful to get any kind of book like this and be like, OK, I'm going to take notes on every single page. I'm going to install it all into my brain, and then I'm going to put it all into practice, because that's just perfectionism by another door. So, yeah, obviously, I can't control how people actually read it. A lot of this book is about easing up on control. So, yeah, I shouldn't be trying to dictate that you read it a chapter every single day. But something along those lines, I think, is really the way to help this kind of perspective shift actually get in there, you know, right in the middle of your busy life, not when you've finally got bandwidth to make a big change or something.
And it's there's a realism about the whole thing, and there's it's grounded. It isn't airy fairy, and it says it as it is. So, like, we're it's tough, and it's worse than you think. You tell us.
Yeah, I mean, look, being a finite human in all the different ways that means, right? Never being able to be confident about what's happening, going to happen in the future, in your own life or in the world at large. Always feeling overwhelmed by how much there is to do. This stuff is just the state of being a human, and it isn't super comfortable. But actually, this idea that I keep coming back to is like, the way to freedom here is to see that it's even worse than you think it is.
Yeah.
Because if you think, just for example, you know, if you think getting on top of all the things that feel like they need doing, if you think that's really difficult, then you're going to spend your whole life in a sort of grueling fight to get there. But if you see that it's worse than really difficult, that it's actually systematically impossible because there are just always be more things that feel meaningful than you have time to do, that's actually quite liberating. You know, that's when you get to say, okay, well, I'll just roll up my sleeves and do a few of the important ones. I'm not going to torture myself anymore with this notion of one day getting to on top of everything.
If you shift and you think to yourself that it's not difficult, it's actually impossible, and that's liberating, right? That's what I'm just repeating so that people, yeah. And you've lovely quotes in it, obviously, and you've, on our behalf, the reader's behalf, you've gone through loads of philosophy and other types of books. And you've sort of gleaned some words of wisdom. One, for example, is our suffering is believing there's a way out. You see, it all sounds quite dark, doesn't it?
it's the darkness before the light.
Is it? That's it.
That's a quote that I love. This idea you get comes a lot in Zen Buddhism, especially.
Yeah.
This idea that the problem is not that you have not solved life, fixed all your problems, organized and decluttered, and, you know, the problem is not that you haven't solved that. The problem is that you think there ought to be a solution to being a human, and that life is like a problem you've got to solve. That's what leads to us feeling so sort of, you know, down on ourselves and overwhelmed and all the rest of it.
And that sounds quite hard to get your head around, doesn't it? But your book is very accessible. That's the brilliant thing about it. Because I'd say, I don't know, I can't speak for our listeners, but I'd say some people are reading about meditation and philosophy and all that, and they dip into it and it just doesn't resonate with them. And that there's a word I've used twice. But your book does, because it's all very practical. The odd thing is you say that, well, I'm paraphrasing you now, if you're looking for a list of things to do, you've come to the wrong place.
Yeah, I mean, one thing people sometimes want, if you're offering them a book about, you know, how to make life feel a bit richer and more meaningful, is like, you know, do this, do this, do this, do this. The thing is, we all know what those things are, right? Nobody needs telling that it's have rich social relationships, try to find meaningful work, spend time in nature. That isn't the problem, right? The problem is not that we don't know what the list is. The problem, in my experience anyway, is you know what the list is and you just don't do it and don't do it for week after week and month after month. So that's what I wanted to focus on.
Yeah.
Some of Ray Darcy's conversation this afternoon with Oliver Berkman. Oliver's latest book, Meditations for Mortals, 4 Weeks to Embrace Your Limitations and Make Time for What Counts, is published by Vintage. Author Jane Casey has been winning awards for her crime fiction for years, and even though her latest novel, The Secret Room, has just been published, diehard fans are already asking when the next one will be out. Crime fiction is enormously popular, but it seems these days that Irish crime fiction is especially so.
What is it about Irish crime writing? Why is it? It feels like it's much bigger now than it was even in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just so much talent in that area of writing at the moment. I mean, like, we always kind of punch above our weight anyway as writers in every genre, but crime is kind of new, that it's the last few years that people have really picked up on it. And what I love about it is that we're all so different. Like, everybody's writing a very different kind of crime novel, but the quality is there.
It is, for sure. And why does Maeve Kerrigan feel like such a friend to people? Because we're 12 books in, but you could kind of pick up any one, really, couldn't you? You could start from there.
Yeah, I mean, people frequently read them out of order. And I actually think I quite like that. Like, I like people to kind of come in near the end and then work out what's going on. I think just, there aren't that many genres where you get to write 12 books about one character and follow them through and have like their kind of personal life running alongside the rest of the story. So there's always the mystery, the crime, but then Maeve's problems go on from book to book.
There's a kind of a Mulder and Scully style relationship, isn't there?
I mean, I've heard it described that way. Yeah. there's a will they, won't they?
There is, what I would say. Yeah. I'm thinking book 12, because book 11 was the first I read. And now there's this one, and I'm going, is the question going to be answered at some point, or is it, you can't say?
I'm not going to spoil anything for anyone.
No, that's Josh and Maeve.
Josh and Maeve.
And her Irishness does emerge every now and again.
Yes, so she has, her parents are very heavily involved in her life. She's two Irish parents. She grew up in London, but she sort of has that dual heritage. So she's like, you know, she's very much an Irish person in London. And they are so heavily involved in her life. And I think for English readers, they're like, is that normal?
Does that seem unusual to English readers?
Very much so, yeah. Really? Yeah, they really, they love it, but they're not used to it. Whereas I think, like, your mother knows everything about you. And nobody else is allowed to criticise you, but she'll put the boot in.
It's those margins between helpful and interfering that we haven't quite sorted out.
Yeah, exactly. They're in your business.
How do the English look at it? Do they see it as interfering if mammy is too close to...
They honestly just don't, like, they might go home twice a year and have like a very polite little meal and then leave again, and that's that's how it goes.
Because maybe she bumps into an Irish person in this one and they have a little kind of a discussion are you too much this way and too little the other? That's the sort of dual thing. Does that affect you, despite the fact that you're born and bred Castleknock, I think, was home.
That's right.
But I mean, like, you're 20 plus years and your family and everything.
I don't do that sum. That's like, the only time I've ever felt really like I wasn't able to come home was during the pandemic. And that was the first time, because it's so easy. Like, you hop on a plane and you're here and you're back and it's home to me.
Mm-hmm. It feels close. But when we go to London, it's like, oh, this is a proper world city. that doesn't understand anything about us. And that's when you sort of feel like, oh, that's where the disjointing comes, I think.
Yeah, we're very familiar with them. I always feel like we're like spies living among them right, yeah. because they have no idea that we're there kind of watching them and judging them. They don't. I don't think that they think of us as being very different. And I think there's a huge cultural gap there.
Do they think of us at all?
I think they, in a kind of a fond and patronising way sometimes.
Really?
I'm speaking of my husband here.
Which you can indeed. Your husband's very useful for the crime novels.
Yes, he is. He's terrific. He's a criminal barrister. So he is in that world of kind of crime. And if he doesn't know the answer to something, he knows somebody who knows the answer.
Really?
So, yeah, okay. He's very useful.
So is he your first reader then when it comes to...
Like with a gun to his head. He's not a fiction reader, so he only does it like he kind of grits his teeth through it. But what he really is looking for is anywhere where one of his good lines has made it into the book. Sometimes he says things and I can see him looking at me and going like, is that going to be something Josh says? Like
really?
He's waiting to see, do I write it down? I do not.
He's a criminal barrister who sees the dark underbelly of society all the time, doesn't he? So
yes.
that's a dark place to dwell. Does he carry it home with him?
Sometimes. I mean, I think anybody who has dealings with people who are in really the worst place in their lives, they have to take it home with them sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a job that he does because he really believes in it. And there's a kind of a moral sort of vocation, if you like, to go and work in that part of the law and to do the best job that he can there.
So he has the English perspective of Irishness. But did he go to college here?
No, I went to college in England.
You went,
that's where we met. But he has...
To Oxford. Very nice.
He has family here. So he's always had like a bit of a connection with Ireland. So I didn't have to start from the beginning and explain everything to him.
What was it like being an Irish youngster in Oxford?
I mean, I look back on it. I think at the time I kind of took it in my stride, as you do when you're 18. But I look back on it and think, my goodness, it was such an odd place to be. And... it was very unfamiliar. It was very Harry Potter. Like, it really was
really?
What they say about it. I remember walking out of my college one morning and seeing a whole group of guys with a pack of hounds and they were going to go hunting.
Gosh, really?
And I was like, this is the middle of a city. What's happening here?
That's weird.
Yeah, it was weird.
But there must be people from all over the world. I mean, you couldn't feel too out of place, presume. Or is there a real intense Englishness about Oxford?
I mean, it is a very English place, but I was in a college that's associated with Wales. So there were lots of Welsh people and they're lovely. And so there was
Kelts.
Kind of a nice, exactly, there was a Celtic fringe aspect to it.
They have that view that they're not thinking about us either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which must be worse when you're on the same island.
We bonded. Yeah, they can never get away.
So you met in Oxford, whirlwind romance?
No, it was a long drawn out situation where I was pursued. No, he turned into my best friend, which is lovely.
Okay.
But not for him, because he did not want to be my best friend.
Oh, I see. Oh, this sounds like the plot. This sounds like the Maeve Kerrigan, Josh thing.
There was a will they, won't they in real life. There was. But yeah, that was resolved.
That one was resolved. Tell us about the plot of this one, because it opens with a locked room mystery. And this is where your fans love to go. They love to find out how you're going to solve this one, essentially.
This is it begins with a very wealthy woman going to a luxury hotel, as she does every Wednesday, for an afternoon with a man who is not her husband. And an hour later, she is dead. She's in a scalding hot bath.
Oh, yeah. This is quite graphic.
I didn't think it was that bad. And I was reading back over it and I thought, actually, this is kind of gruesome.
I had to jump in with a warning there. I'm sorry, the air of the day and so on. But there is a gruesome death involving scalding water.
She's in a scalding hot bath and there's no way that she can have been murdered. And yet she has been.
Because no one else has come in and out of the room. The CCTV captures the fella who visits, as
That's
he does
right.
every Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it doesn't appear he's done it.
He doesn't have time to do it.
No.
So it's a proper mystery.
And Maeve, who's very good at spotting everything, including people's luggage and where they've just flown in from with the codes and so on, that you have all cleverly put in to tell the newcomers that this is a very sharp detective. She has to solve this frustrating mystery. And then you just throw in another crazy mystery.
Just throw in another. Yeah. So she's just kind of getting to grips with this. And then Josh is arrested and he is in real trouble this time. And she has to try and get him out of that trouble that he's in.
And her parents are very useful to her because they're obviously Irish parents.
They are. They step in. They help. So she has a lot of support from them. But obviously it comes with the comments and the input that you might not necessarily appreciate.
But the mother is a strong woman, isn't she? And she gives very useful advice.
Yeah, there's a bit where Maeve says if she had been a detective, then there wouldn't have been a crime for 20 miles because she spots everything. She misses nothing.
Proper Irish mammy.
Absolutely.
Jane Casey talking to Oliver Callan this morning. Jane's latest novel, The Secret Room, is published by Hemlock Press. Weight Watchers, the original slimming club, has filed for bankruptcy. In the era of super drugs like Ozempic, is there a future for calorie-counting slimming clubs? That's the question Claire Byrne put to Aoife Hearn, registered dietitian and lecturer at SETU Waterford, this morning.
Because they were so focused on calories and so focused on restriction, and we actually know that when people engage in this type of dieting, that it actually increases your risk of gaining weight and potentially obesity. So I think, you know, a lot of people found them quite useful and supportive, and there was an educational piece to them that I think had value. But I at least would love to see, and I know many people working in the area would love to see something where we're really trying to empower people to make better choices in their lifestyle, food and movement, and focusing more on health outcomes, I guess, rather than just the number and the scale. Mm-hmm.
The other side of those groups, though, was the social outlet that it gave people, you know, and the help and support and education, as you say, when people would meet up and hear from their group leader about what was the right thing to be doing for your health and nutrition.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I would say that while their intention may have been to be judgment free, you know, I think we do have to understand that many people living with obesity or living in bigger bodies have a lot of internalized shame around that. And so, you know, when you're in a situation that maybe you go, you get weighed in, you're up a pound and you're not sure why that is, that can be really, really difficult for people to deal with. And they're then in a situation, I guess, where there's no one with professional qualifications to support them through why that may have happened, you know. So, you know, I suppose there's two sides to the coin, isn't there, you know. But, you know, I suppose we are looking now what's going to happen without them, isn't it?
Well, it is. And we have, you know, the introduction of the drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy, and the whole landscape really of weight loss has been transformed, which you agree, because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, but I think, you know, what we really have to be clear about is that our GLP medication, so Wegovy, Mounjaro, Ozempic, these are medications for people who have a chronic disease, you know. And I know there's been lots of commentary about, you know, losing a few pounds to go on your holidays, but like, that's not what these medications are for, you know. And so these medications are part of how we care for people who have obesity. There will be people who don't have obesity and may want to make some changes, you know. So I think it is important that we kind of differentiate between the two, you know.
So what happens for those people then who are caught there in the middle, you know, who won't be able to or shouldn't be using the weight loss drugs but would like to drop a few pounds or half a stone or whatever it might be?
Yeah, and I think what we're really looking at now is that there probably is a gap to how do we support people around nutrition education, you know. And there isn't anything consistent across the country that people can access. And I do think that's an issue, you know. If people can afford it, of course they can get support from a private dietitian or a physiotherapist or a fitness expert. So, but when you're not in that position, you know, you're probably left open to looking at Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, all these things where we see lots of unqualified people giving information that has no evidence behind it. Mm-hmm. So that's, I suppose, the concern, you know.
Well, maybe even would you say the slimming club model now has moved online and the people might be involved in some sort of an online support group or program and getting their guidance from there?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's pluses and minuses with that, isn't there? You know, I suppose I'd always encourage people to make sure that the nutrition advice you're getting is from a registered dietitian or a registered nutritionist, someone who has a full-time 4-year undergraduate degree under their belt. You know, say, just like you would, you wouldn't get medical advice from someone who's not a doctor. I hope you wouldn't, at least. But, you know, so it is, we just, I suppose there's a lot of education that we really need to do now to support mm-hmm. the public to make better choices. And I think when it comes to eating, you know, there's so much focus, and still probably people, the go-to is if they want to fit into their, go on their holidays or Christmas party, they look at restriction. And what we really want people to start thinking is, well, you know, what can I actually bring into my eating? How can I plan my eating better? What are the some of the choices that we actually can take charge of, rather than just focusing on this one thing, meaning weight, that we actually don't have as much control over as we would like to believe?
Well, that the body positivity movement, there has been some talk that that message has been lost now because of these weight mm-hmm. loss drugs. You know, that notion that you can be healthy at any size.
Mm-hmm. And I think, and that is important. I think we can all be healthy at many sizes, and it's not really the size that matters. It's what we do is important. So are we eating enough vegetables and fruit in the day? Are we getting enough fiber? Are we moving regularly? Are we drinking in moderation? Do we quit smoking or don't smoke to begin with? Like, these are the pillars that we know are important for long-term health and longevity. And so, again, it's trying to focus on more of this inclusion approach, I suppose, mm-hmm. rather than, oh, I just can't have a takeaway, or I'm going to give up drinking for a month, or whatever it might be, you know?
Wise words from registered dietitian and lecturer at SETU Waterford, Aoife Hearn, on Today with Clare Byrne this morning. Following up on yesterday's programme, Colm O'Mungone brought us a call from Jacintha on this afternoon's live line to talk some more about those pesky drones.
Now, where I'm living, it's not every day, but no, it was just something that when I heard you covering it yesterday, I think that there needs to be a bit of thought around drones and the drone deliveries. I'm living in Dublin 15, and it seems to be one of the up-and-coming areas for drones and drone deliveries. And I also live in a small terraced house, mid-terrace, and I'm back onto mid-terraces, so our gardens are very small. And when drones are delivering food, you apparently have to, your back garden has to be empty. So when they're delivering to my neighbour, the drone is actually over my garden, and then this a door opens at the bottom of the spaceship, and a bag comes out and is dropped down. And I just thought I'd, when you were covering it yesterday, I thought I'd send you a text just saying there's privacy issues there as well. And I know Roderick O'Gorman was raising an issue about it, but I think that they need to look at maybe doing drone deliveries in front gardens.
Right, so just the back garden has to be empty for a delivery to take place. So does that mean the drone hovers over a neighbouring garden while it waits for the other garden to get clear, is it?
Well, I assume that the garden is cleared, but it's for it to line up. And I mean, if there's a bit of a wind or whatever, they have to line up, hover over a neighbour's garden. And it's like a scene out of the Minority Report. You're kind of waiting on Tom Cruise to come down on a rope and little robotic spiders come in and check, are you doing what you're supposed to be doing?
Would you mind them as much if Tom Cruise did come down the rope?
Well, at my age and at his age, maybe we could have a cup of tea.
Right. And come here to me, what things are people getting delivered on the drones? What do you see coming out? Geez. If it's not little spiders, what is coming out of these drones?
No, a brown paper bag. So it could be money. It could be anything. I don't know. It's a brown paper bag. But just look, all I'm saying is, you know, I mean, I know that it's not a huge issue and people don't get deliveries every day, but I assume that the people that own the drone companies are going to be pushing for more business and more business. So we're all going to have drones hovering over us. And I just think maybe there should be some rules that it's in the front garden, or when it's high density, maybe they need to look at a different type of delivery.
And would you hear them? Are they loud?
Absolutely. You could be in the other part of the house and you hear this. It's dum dum dum. It's like that other film with the helicopters coming up, like this blades going over your
apocalypse
over your
now,
head.
Is it?
Apocalypse, yes. Yeah. And I just thought, look, I mean, I know I heard that poor woman that got herself into trouble with the visitors. So it's nothing like that. But I just sent a text saying, you know, there are issues there, and I think that, you know, you could let this slide, but I think it needs to be looked at and considered.
Right. I think the line from Apocalypse Now is, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, but I love the smell of a fast food delivery at lunchtime. But come here to me, you wouldn't be tempted ever, if the service is available, you wouldn't be tempted, having seen it in operation and knowing that it at least works and delivers, you've never been tempted, have you?
Well, no, but now that's only because, you know, my vintage, I prefer to cook for myself or go out for something to eat. It's more sociable than having something delivered down into my back garden and me to sit there eating it. But just look, as I say, I thought I'd send a text just to say it's another aspect of, I'm not against progress. I think it's, I think there's huge benefits for drones and prescription delivery and things like that. And so what if people want food delivered? But I just think they need to look at the rules around invading other people's privacy.
Right.
I mean, I'd hate to be younger if I wanted to go out and sunbathe in my back garden, do a skinny dip or a skinny sunbathe. But I'm a bit past that now. So,
never say never.
Well, that's true. Never say never. But I'm still waiting on, I'll keep waiting on Tom Cruise to come down.
All right. I just, is there a pattern? Is it more at weekends? Is it in the evenings? You know, is it kind of, have you noticed any particular busy time?
I could, but I don't want to shock my neighbour for, I assume that they do it when there isn't other people around in the house. But no, certainly I've been up at the Blanchardstown Centre and in the evening time, and it's constant drones going. And the same with Junction 6 there on the Navan Road. Drones going constantly. Now, I don't know whether they're all delivering food or whether they're delivering groceries. I don't know. But, right.
I've heard of somebody getting a cup of coffee delivered with one. Just one cup
regular.
Of coffee lowered down.
Oh,
really?
Absolute. Oh, that's absolutely a regular. I could tell you people that do that all the time.
And would it still be warm by the time it lands?
I assume it has to be. Sure, who would be looking for cold coffee? But then I suppose they can nuke it in the microwave. But no, that's a very much popular. But it's now the food deliveries is a regular. But I know somebody who got ice cream delivered because they were having a family party.
Right. I wonder how they stopped the coffee spilling.
There must be some sort of a mechanism inside. So all of that, think about it, Colm. All of that has to be dealt with when the door has opened in the drone. They have to untie or release the whatever it is, and then it is dropped down. It looks to me like the rope doesn't go back up. It must be some sort of a fine thing that can be just dropped. But it's only an accident waiting to happen if a blade comes off. Or
I wonder would they ever be tempted to tease somebody? You know, the way as a kid, you know, an older brother or somebody might hold a lollipop over your head and get you to jump up and down a few times. Would the drone operator ever be tempted to drag the bag back up and lower it down again and see somebody on the camera jumping up and down in their back garden? Yeah.
Oh, and video it and put it up on Instagram or something. Absolutely. Yeah,
right.
That's another thing, you know.
They can pay you the commission if they use that marketing idea you sent them.
Well, now you came up with it, so...
Okay, joint enterprise. We'll split it. Fair enough.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark, thanks very much, Jacinta.
Thank you.
Mark,
thanks.
Good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Now, we heard from Jacinta in a built-up area. You're not in a built-up area. You're in a rural area, a farmer.
Yeah, I'm a farmer, yeah. I suppose, look, it's become, you know, more prevalent as time has gone on. You know, we see drones from time to time, not every day now, but we see them much more common, you know. And I suppose there's two real aspects here. Firstly, you know, who's behind it? Who's driving this drone? We don't know them. You know, it's totally different to, for argument's sake, if somebody comes and walks the field and I happen to bump into them, I can interview them. I can have a chat with them, see what their... Why are they there? Or
right.
You know,
how long?
They,
just how long? How long is it going on?
Sure, it's only going on a few years, really. But like, you know, we would have, you know,
how
maybe
often?
About a year ago. I'd see one every couple of months, really. But they'd be farming over. They'd be coming over my farm, you know, whether it's the farmyard or, you know, when we were out fencing one day and one came to within 15 feet of us, for argument's sake. Now, what is it doing looking at us? I don't know.
Drones and the way they might look at you, as discussed on this afternoon's Live Line with Colm O'Mungoin. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, festival season is almost upon us. And one of the very biggest in this part of the world is Glastonbury, which takes place in June. Claire Byrne got Simon Marr, founder of 8radio.com, in to talk about the history of the festival and some of the best performances at it over the years.
So take us through the history here of Glastonbury. We need to go back to the 70s, do we?
We do. I love this idea because the idea was that people didn't want to be part of the music industry. So they wanted to run all of these free festivals. So they set them up and it would be people would trail around for the whole summer and go to these free festivals in various fields. And Michael Eavis was one of those people and he decided to allow a festival to take place on his farm. And it was called the Pilton Pop Blues and Folk Festival. And it cost £1 to get in for the whole weekend. And you got all the milk you could drink from Michael Eaves' cows.
Lovely. So this was pushback against the machine at that time.
Big time. Big time. Yeah.
So was it copying the Isle of Wight festival?
There was a whole bunch of those festivals that were going on at the time. And the idea was that you would start off in May and you would start at festival number one and then you would trail your way around in your bus or your trailer or whatever it was and you'd spend your summer going to all of these festivals.
With flowers in your hair.
Absolutely.
And big flares on.
Absolutely, yeah.
Love and, the sound
and,
of it.
And prog rock bands playing 25-minute guitar solos. So that's what you had.
The first act that made Simon's list was Johnny Cash, back in 1994.
And I think anybody who was at that particular gig was like, oh yeah, there's something a bit special here.
And just the fact that he picks Glastonbury, like he just is effortlessly cool, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, completely so, completely so.
So the next pick we're going to is 1995, so the year after Johnny Cash, in fact, and Pulp were a last minute addition that year to the running order.
Mid-90s, you were either looking at sort of Oasis Blur or whatever, but they went that bit more left field and they went for Pulp and it was a fantastic set. Fantastic set. And they're back. They're just about to release their first album in 24 years. They played in Dublin in a few weeks' time. First album in 24 years, but that's an iconic performance. Mm-hmm.
Legendary. So you told us how it got started in the 70s, but then it wasn't really until the 80s that it grew and became the sort of icon, to go back to that word again,
yeah,
of festivals that it is now.
That's the thing, is that I suppose they really thought of it as being that sort of music and culture festival for a long time. And then I think by the time the 1980s came around, it was like, well, there's a huge potential to make a pile of money out of this, which means we can do more. And in their case, in the case of the Eaveses, they wanted to build the famous pyramid stage. There was all sorts of things that they wanted to do. So they figured, right, this has got to grow. And it grew massively in the 1980s to a point where you could have 100,000 people at a stage.
Mm-hmm. So it was started as, you know, the anti-industry event. And then it became the industry.
It became the industry, but I think the idea and the Eaves' idea was very much that you use the industry and the capitalist side of it in order to fund all of the other things that you want to do.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the infrastructure around it then, you know, it went from being in the field and all the rest to like having a sort of sprawling temporary city.
That's the thing. And it is. And that's one of the main reasons why so many people go to Glastonbury isn't just for the music, but it's to be part of that city. You know, and even in those very, very early days, the end of the 60s and into the 70s, it was all about that sort of, I suppose, that collective thing that you have. But the collective thing, as it grew and it grew and it grew, when you get into hundreds of thousands of people, but people still go to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Often referred to as the greatest Glastonbury performance ever, David Bowie's set in 2000 is next up on Simon's list.
I think it's what happens is people are surprised and the performers are just as surprised as the audiences by whatever feeling, whatever vibe, whatever it is that they get from playing at Glastonbury. And I think sort of Bowie had been around. Obviously, he had been huge in the 60s. He managed to reinvent himself all of the time. But by the time he got into the 1990s, we were in the Tin Machine days. We're in days where people were kind of going, is he a bit of an aging, you know, an aging icon? But still, as he really got more much to say. And then he came and he played Glastonbury in the year 2000. And even though there's 120,000 people standing, you know, standing in front of the stage, as he was doing the quieter songs, you could literally hear, you know, a hippie's pin drop. And I think it must be the two-way. It's got to be the two-way vibe that goes on. Is that does it? But I always, it's a regret that I will have forever, which is that I saw Bowie round about the time, but I saw him in Tin Machine, and it was awful stuff altogether. But the Bowie of that era, and the Bowie right the way up until his death, you know, 15, 16 years later, you know, really was something that everybody should experience.
Now, let's come further up the timeline. So 2008 was Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Then 2011, Beyonce. That was controversial, wasn't it?
See, today, both of them were controversial. And I suppose because when a festival starts off, it started off very much in the, you were rock bands. It was prog rock, you know. So it was seven white blokes with keyboards.
But if you look at what Eva said right at the beginning, the Pilton Pop Blues and Folk Festival.
Yeah.
Anybody is allowed under those headings.
Oh, and theoretically they were, but I suppose just because the style of the time was always, it has to be long-haired guys with guitars and huge keyboard stacks. So when the likes of Jay-Z came along, it's like, how can somebody like Jay-Z hold a crowd? You know,
and he did.
Yeah, and he did, yeah. And when Beyonce came then to 2011, you know, and it was like, there's no way that you're going to have somebody who's going to be able to hold a crowd like this. And literally the palm of 120,000 people in the palm of Beyonce's hand.
I saw live in Dublin. She is incredible live. Incredible. Yeah.
Some of the best performances from Glastonbury over the years, according to Simon Marr. But what's the story with this year's festival?
The big challenge has always been, and Emily Evis, who kind of pretty much runs the festival these days, is that a huge amount of the challenge now is how do you keep the festival relevant without it just being, I suppose, a heritage, almost a tribute festival, which is huge business. But is it necessarily where they wanted to go with Glastonbury? Mm-hmm. They said, no, it's not. So you got to bring in the likes of your, you know, Dua Lipa. But even then, you're still going to go back. And even though you're going to have Olivia Rodrigo and Fred again, Kneecap, of course, who've been in the news as well, you're going to have bands like that. People will still go and say, well, who's going to be in the legend slot? You know, Johnny Cash, 1994 was in the legend. So many people, Dolly Parton.
A lot riding on it, isn't there?
Everybody has done it. So it's difficult to keep it up to date. But I think so far they've done a pretty good job.
Simon Noir, founder of 8radio.com, talking about past and future Glastonbury performances with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this last Tuesday in April edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with a sunnier, smileier, professionalier look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.